Well, I would say this is one of the things that's going to set the book apart. And this is not, again, this is not an egotistical claim. This is just a factual claim. What you will read presented in this book exists in no other commentary you will ever pick up. And the reason for that is not that, oh, Mike's just so smart. No, the reason is because the Mesopotamian context for the Genesis 6 event, Genesis 6, 1 through 4, had only got a systematic reevaluation in the last few years, specifically 2010. If you're an academic, okay, like me, you're reading academic journals. Well, again, I actually posted this one on my blog because I thought it was so important. And people can go up to Naked Bible and search for the article by Annus, Annus, and you'll find it. Just put it in the search field, you'll find it. But Amar Annus is a Mesopotamian, a cuneiform scholar who decided to comb through all of the stuff, all of the stuff about the flood and before the flood in Mesopotamian, Akkadian, Babylonian literature to see if there were parallels to Genesis 6, sort of to, take a whack at it again. Because really the last time this had been done was turn of the 20th century. Well, his article just essentially is a game changer. And it's 2010. So all those commentaries that your pastors are used to using that you may know about, they are all by definition out of date when it comes to Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And I have that material in the book. And again, I make it decipherable. Here's the short version of it. Genesis 6, 1 through 4 is deliberately written to take a theological swipe at certain beliefs of the Babylonians. Okay, there are characters in Babylonian religion called the Apkallu, and they are point for point just what you read about before and after the flood in the Genesis 6, 1 through 4 account. They're divine beings, they cohabit with human women. After they're giant in size after the flood, okay? Because what the Mesopotamian story does is you have these divine beings who possess divine knowledge, and to make sure that knowledge was not lost, okay, during the flood, they cohabit, they pass it on to humans in that way, and the result of that again are these Apkallu, but they're hybrid Apkallu, and they're giants and whatnot. Gilgamesh is an example. Gilgamesh is on a seal, a cylinder seal that again, this artist is described as sort of a lord of the Apkallu, something like that. And Gilgamesh is two-thirds divine, one-third human, all that kind of stuff. So, the two-third, one-third thing, obviously, mixtures. Well, all of that's going on in Babylonian stuff. And the Babylonians say, hey, isn't this awesome? Because this is why we in Babylon are the best. This is why we're the smartest. We are the ones that possess divine knowledge of the gods, and this is why we're at the top of the heap of the world, and everybody else is just dog meat. Okay, well, the Israelites again are like, well, that's not exactly the case. So I, either Genesis 6, 1 through 4 was an addition to something, written earlier, or whether it was composed in Babylon or it was an addition made in Babylon, doesn't really matter to me. But the Babylonian tone of it is just spot on. Genesis 6, 1 through 4 says, okay, well, let us tell you what's really going on with this story. And we get the sons of God. We get the cohabitation language. We get the Nephilim afterwards. And you know what? That wasn't good. In fact, that was a horrible thing because it not only was part of the mixture that God judged with the flood, but it's also the link to the enemies that are going to oppose the people of God and try to exterminate them. So you get all this going on, and Genesis 6, 1 through 4, again, takes a swipe at the presumed superiority that the Babylonians think they have, and their spin on what happened before and after the flood, with divine knowledge and divine beings and all this other stuff. It's a punch in the nose to their gods, to the Apkallu and what results from it. Now, here's the point. Here's why that's important. Here's why that context is so crucial. two things. The people writing, the Jews writing in between the Testaments, what we call Second Temple literature or intertestamental literature. This is when books like Enoch and the Jubilees and other stuff like that was written. Jews between the Testaments saw that very clearly. They understood the original Mesopotamian context for it. And that's why all of this supernatural stuff, that the sons of God are really divine beings and the Nephilim and all this stuff, that's why that shows up in that literature. We know Peter and Jude were reading that literature because of what they write, specifically Tartarus and all that kind of stuff, stuff that isn't mentioned in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. There's stuff that they're reading that influences the way they articulate what they say in 2 Peter 2 and Jude about what happens before the flood, sin, the sin of the angels and all that stuff. So that's one reason why it's important. It establishes the fact that Jews writing between the Testaments weren't just sucking it out of their thumb. They understood the original context to it. The second reason it's important is because any view, any interpretation of Genesis 6, 1 through 4 that dismisses the supernatural context for what's written there is illegitimate. Okay, in other words, if you're not going to interpret the sons of God, the Nephilim, as divine and quasi-divine beings, if you're going to just interpret them as just normal men, normal people, like the Sethite view, you are hopelessly misguided. You should just, when you, the phrase, let's interpret the Bible in context, should never come out of your mouth again. If you're going to dismiss the supernatural context,
right,
that is the backdrop to Genesis 6, 1 through 4. I don't care if you don't like it. And again, like I say in the book, there's really two supernatural, there's two ways to parse what goes on in Genesis 6, 1 through 4 that preserves a supernatural reading, a supernatural worldview of that passage. But if you're not in that territory, if you're off in Sethite land, okay, with some of the church fathers, then you should just politely excuse yourself from talking about interpreting the Bible in its original context, because you're violating that. Okay, so you have a choice to make. You're either going to get serious about interpreting the Bible in its original context, or you're not.
Right.
Okay, you're either going to honor the idea, or you're not. It's as simple as that. But again, for your audience, it's like, even if the Sethite view made sense, and it doesn't, it's got all sorts of internal problems, but even if it didn't have those problems, it is not in accord with the original context that the biblical writer, the person who penned those four verses, even if the Sethite view made sense, it is out of step with what the biblical writer was trying to communicate in those four verses. I mean, I am telling people, look, you're going to read stuff in Unseen Realm that you not only haven't heard before, you just won't find it. That's not because, oh, Mike thinks he's so much smarter than anybody else. No, it's because people do work, and I pay attention to their work, to the literature, and Unseen Realm just happened to be a timely outlet for that material. So you get it, and the commentaries your pastors are using, you know, or you're using yourself, you know, I'm sorry, but when it comes to Genesis 6, 1 through 4, they're just out of date. Yeah, and I do go through the options in Unseen Realm. I think the easiest path, I prefer this one not because it's easy, but because it makes sense of some of the Philistine connections. I think the easiest path is a local or regional flood, because what that enables a survival of a remnant, of a vestige, and what's appealing about it is, and there are some good, you know, textual indications that a regional flood could be possible from the flood account. The phrase is all flesh, all the earth, the whole earth. You actually can find those identical phrases elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible where they cannot refer to the entire planet where they cannot refer to every human being. So given that possibility, and again, this isn't unique to me, people say, well, maybe, you know, maybe this event is regional because, and here's why it gets on the table, because of Genesis 10. All the nations that the biblical writer knows about happen to be in the Mediterranean and the ancient Near East. There's no India, there's no China, there's no Australia, there's no New Zealand, there's no North and South America, there's none of that.
Right. Okay,
so maybe what's being described is a regional event. And if that's the case, and again, textually you can justify it, even in the flood account, there are places where, again, depending on how you're taking the chronology of events and how you're taking the phrases, it turns out to be a regional event. But even in the context of Genesis 10, well, that's everybody that they know about anyway, but we know it's not the whole planet. So, you know, there are a couple ways to get there. But what I find interesting about it is when you get to the Philistines, who are referred to as Rephaim, descendants of Rephah and all that kind of stuff, and they're obviously, you get Goliath's dimensions, so he's, you know, in the tradition of the Anakim and all that kind of stuff. The Philistines archaeologically come from what scholars refer to as the Sea Peoples. And they come from the Aegean. And so, again, it's entirely possible that you could have had a regional event, but you still have vestiges of what's going on in Genesis 6, 1 through 4 in these coastal areas or seafaring nations, if you want to call that, that survive because it's a regional event. You know, according to the, you know, the perspective, I mean, look at the flood account. This is sort of from Noah's perspective. Well, from Noah's perspective, again, and it's very much Babylonish located, you know, in the language of the flood story. Again, you have this Babylonian context. Yeah, everything he could see, everybody that they knew about is gone. Erased, you know, the flood takes care of that, but yet you still have this vestige remain. So I think it's not perfect, it's not without its problems, but I think it's probably the easiest path. And again, I like the connection to the Philistines. It would make sense on that level. But the unseen realm, I go through some of the other ones. If you think the flood was global, then probably your best option is to take the grammar of Genesis 6:4, because it is legitimate. You can translate that verse about that there were, you know, there were Nephilim upon the earth, you know, and after, and most translations have when the sons of God, you know, went into the daughters of men, but you can actually translate that whenever. In other words, so that there would have been some repetition. Now, getting a little bit into the content of the book, the second supernatural view would take Genesis 6, 1 through 4, not as direct sexual cohabitation, but still supernatural divine intervention to raise up certain bloodlines. And people, you know, your listeners might say, well, what's the difference? What is he talking about? Okay, think of Abraham and Sarah. It's very clear that Yahweh has to intervene in some way to enable Abraham and Sarah to have a child, who's Isaac, again, the child of the promise. It never says that there's anything sexual going on between Yahweh and Sarah, nothing like that. But it's very clear that there's a divine intervention. Same thing with Hannah. She's childless, and she gives the Lord credit for opening her womb and all that kind of stuff. There is thinking like this in Scripture, and Abraham and Sarah are a good example where you have divine intervention specifically on Yahweh's part to produce his portion, his people, according to the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. Well, that raises the question, well, maybe Genesis 6, 1 through 4, maybe the sexual language there is trying to communicate the idea that other rival gods somehow intervened to create certain bloodlines, produce certain bloodlines, specifically to wipe out Yahweh's people. You know, in other words, this is coming down the road specifically to raise up a people for themselves at some point, you know, whatever the motivation might have been at the time. Again, it takes you into the chronology of events that you have to sort out. But there's still this notion of supernatural divine intervention that ultimately results in this conflict that we see played out in the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. Well, if that's the case, if you take Genesis 6:4 as iterative, as this could happen again, that's actually workable. You know, so in the context of a global flood, you could say, well, you know, the divine beings just said, you know what? We don't like Israel. We don't like Yahweh. You know, and when they get put in charge of, you know, other divine beings get put in charge of the nations and they become corrupt as well, they could say, you know what? You know, back what was going on before the flood, you know, we're going to take matters into our own hands and we're going to oppose Yahweh too. We're going to raise up a people to eliminate his people. I mean, again, it gives you that option. Again, it gives you that interpretive option. So again, for those who would favor a global flood, I think that's probably the most workable way to go for this whole thing about after the flood. Again, some sort of hostile divine intervention could be. I mean, ultimately, you know, we don't know specifically, but what we do know is that there are statements of scripture that need to be thought about, you know, and proposals offered for how this could be and how this could work out.